We've come in our study of 1 Thessalonians to the last exhortations that Paul wants to give to the church at large. In a sense, he's established his thesis and he's gone through the details of making every effort to get the Thessalonians to buy into it. His thesis is that you must live by hope. If hope dies, everything is worthless. You won't live by faith if you don't have any hope. You won't live by love if you don't have any hope. And obviously, if you have no hope, you'll be hopeless. Most people don't realize how critical this issue of hope is, but it is everywhere. I mentioned to you last time, a little girl in middle school that made a profession of faith in Christ, and within a year she got so depressed with the way things were that she killed herself. Well, that's the ultimate act of hopelessness. No question about it. You do not do that to yourself until every avenue of expectation or hope is gone. And Paul would argue in this letter that the steadfastness or the endurance of hope is a critical element of living life. As we saw in the last couple of studies when we actually moved into verses 11 through 13 and now into verses 14 through 22, we see that Paul is building off of his thesis. That's what the wherefore in verse 11 is all about. I know it's translated therefore in the New American Standard, but he's laid his foundation and now he's drawing some conclusions. And he wants the church as a body to encourage one another and build up one another, just like they've been doing, but more so. And then he asks in verses 12 and 13 that the church as a whole take a certain attitude toward those that God had elevated in the group to be in charge of the group's spiritual life and health. Those are typically identified in the scriptures as elders. And elders can't elder, if you can turn that into a verb, unless the people are willing to allow it. It's kind of like the prison warden who says, we govern here by consent. Because there's far more prisoners than there are of us. If they didn't allow us to carry out our jobs and stuff, we couldn't. Well, in a very real sense, that's true in the church too. Elders can't function as elders in enabling, building up, edifying, all of that kind of stuff if people don't take the right kind of attitude toward them. And so in verses 12 and 13, he addressed the issue of adopting the right kind of attitude toward those who are in the Lord over you and have charge over you. Now, in verse 14, we looked last time at how, in a very real sense, this is a charge to the church as a whole because he addresses the brethren and he identifies those in chapter 1 as chosen by God, brethren, beloved by God. So these are the beloved, these are the people of God, and therefore he's addressing the whole group and he told them to do three things with a fourth attached at the end. And the three things had to do with, as the text translates it, admonishing the unruly. I took that as an outworking of verse 23, where you edify people in the area of their spirit when they are out of line and you confront them and try to get them to get back in line. Because that's the word urge, parakalesis. Call them back to the walk. And so admonishing the unruly or addressing the false agendas of those who are creating problems by not following the form, those are to be confronted. And then the phrase, encourage the faint-hearted, we actually changed the translation of both the verbal idea and the noun, because the verbal idea of encouragement, that's a very difficult term to find any real support in most places, but the etymology of it actually means to come alongside the myths. The noun form of the word that's translated encourage in this text is the word myth. And so the implication is that when you have somebody who is, quote, faint-hearted, they are believing in myths that don't exist in reality, and you need to draw alongside them and expose the myths and cause them to not be faint-hearted anymore, but we also argued that faint-hearted doesn't mean faint-hearted. That usually means being a coward. Faint-hearted means to have a small soul that can't make loyalty decisions in relationships. And really, that's an exploding problem in our culture. People who simply can't make relational commitments and stick with them. That's why the divorce rates are as high as they are. I told you about the movie star, whatever, that said, I still think that we're supposed to stay together forever or for a lifetime or whatever. Well, all she was saying is, I got a small soul. I believe in the myth of life without any of those relational commitments. And when that's found in the church, somebody's supposed to draw alongside that small-souled individual and expose the myths that are being believed and leaned on. And then helping the weak, that's probably addressing the body, the sick, getting a grip on them so that their sickness isn't turned in to a basis for their departure from loyalty to God. Because people, when they get sick, often allow their physical feelings to cause them not to depend on the Spirit of God anymore, and they get short-tempered and nasty and, you know, sick people. Well, church isn't supposed to let that happen either. And we just made the case, or tried to make the case last time, that this is the spirit, the soul, and the body terminology of verse 24. And then be patient with everybody, which means we're broken, takes a long time to fix us, and therefore confronting, exposing myths, getting a grip on the sick, just be aware that one time won't probably do it. It's going to take some consistency and pursuit and, you know, perseverance in that. And that's what being patient's all about. So that's kind of where we were last time. And this time we're going to be looking again at a verse 15. I'm not planning to do a study on each verse. Verse 16 is, I mean, I could probably. And we may. I haven't made up my mind. But several of these verses are very short exhortations. But nonetheless, verse 15 is not that short. So I decided, well, we'll take on another one. The New American Standard translators say, see that no one repays another with evil for evil, but always seek after that which is good for one another and for all men. So we're going to look at that. This is, I think, a summons to the church as a whole to be responsible in a certain way, in a certain setting. There's a very specific focus in the verse. It's the setting where somebody has been subjected to evil by somebody else. And he's giving the somebody who's been subjected to evil some very clear expectation type exhortations, because when a person's subjected to evil, their true interests begin to bubble up and they have a strong tendency to lose sight of those interests when true evil makes its appearance. I had a young lady tell me just recently that she got a very caustic comment made about something she'd said about the Lord on whatever, Twitter, whatever. I don't know what she was on. But one of these, one of these social media things. And she said, in deep anger, I reacted immediately, and I started typing, and I knew when I was typing that I should not send this, I should not be posting this, but I was so angry I did it anyway. That's what I mean about things coming, bubbling up whenever you're subjected to evil. Because that hits right close, too close to home, and we need some encouragement and some exhortation about what to do in that kind of setting. So, that's where we are in verse 15. The basic command in verse 15 starts with a verb that's translated see. See that no one repays evil for evil. No, see that no one repays another with evil for evil. See to it. Well, that's kind of an interesting command because the verb that's translated see is used across a pretty broad spectrum, and it starts with actual physical sight. You see something, and because you see something, you start drawing some conclusions and thinking in a certain way because of what you're seeing. The scriptures, of course, are very clear that sight can be misleading, and you have to be very careful not to base your faith walk on what you can see, because what you can see often has multiple interpretive possibilities, and you may not have the wisdom or skill in interpreting properly, and so then your faith may because of what you're seeing. But the fact is, that verb is used with this physical sight thing, but from this end of the spectrum, where physical sight's in view, starts a continuum that goes all the way over to here, to where the same word is used when you can't see it at all with your eyes. And John is a classic user of the term because he says in 1 John, in the first three verses, that which we have seen with our eyes and our hands have handled concerning the word of life, that which we have seen and heard, we declare to you. So twice he says, look, we're talking about stuff we've seen. And in 1 John, the whole point of starting out that way is to try to establish an epistemology where you can know this stuff because we saw it with our eyes. And in a very real sense, that just flies in the face of what I just said about developing your theology on the basis of what you can see. But there's a positive side to that, in that the same author in John 1, the Gospel of John, says that the Word of God, who was God, became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld, we saw His glory. And because we saw it, we can bear witness to you of what we've seen, and then you can believe like we do about Him. Well, that's obviously got to have some place in our thinking about seeing things and then developing conclusions from them, because on the one hand, 1 John rests heavily on that which we have seen with our eyes, that which we have seen, we declare to you. In three verses, he says it three times. So, he's obviously trying to say, look, if you're going to reject this, you're going to reject in spite of the fact that it's established in visible history. And of course, there are all kinds of examples of that in Scripture. How much of the Bible would we really believe if we had no eyewitnesses of any of the things that are there? If you took all of the stuff that was recorded there, that was recorded because somebody actually saw it, experienced it, whatever, what would be left? A few prophets and some songs, you know. Because even with God's dealings with the nation of Israel, He brought these people out of the land of Egypt. They were a rebellious, motley crew. And He took them through 10 cycles of seeing Him do things. And finally He got tired of it. Said, you guys are just stiff-necked, hardcore rebels. And I'm just going to let you wander around out here till you're all dead, and we'll take your kids and fulfill the promises to them. So, you know, God runs out of patience sometimes. But my point is, John was clearly putting his message in the realm of physical phenomena. And he's just as clearly arguing that the physical phenomena have certain specific implications that are fundamentally indisputable as to their truth. That's what 1 John's rooted in. And then in 1 John, chapter 3, verse 6, and again in chapter 4, verse 20, he deliberately cast the issue in the realm of clear understanding rather than physical sight. Because he knows that if you've seen something but you don't understand what you've seen, it's of no value to see it. In other words, if you see something, you don't understand what that significance of that sight is, then you will apply a significance that's not legitimate, and the seeing didn't help you at all. And in 1 John, he talks about the greater importance of being able to draw the right kinds of conclusions. And he talks about how can you say you love God whom you have not seen if you don't love your brother whom you have seen. And he uses this term. And he's in effect saying you haven't seen God. But there are certain things that are true about him that are very core, and you've got to draw the right kind of conclusions from them. So what I'm trying to argue here is that Paul falls right in line with John in his use of this term, because he uses it to refer in some ways, like in 1 Corinthians 9, verse 1, he talks about seeing things with your eyes. But in this text, when he says, see that, no one, he's not talking about seeing with your eyes. What he's talking about is understanding something that has its roots in accurate truth theology and being able to draw the conclusions from that that ought to be drawn. And we talked last time about how difficult it is in our culture for people to draw legitimate conclusions, because we have so many people saying, well, I'm a Christian, and I don't see any problem with, and then they'll go off talking about some sin they're doing. And you say, how can you be a Christian and think like that? Well, it's very possible, because it's happening all day, every day. People claim to be Christians and turn right around and do something that's anti-Christian. Well, Paul is saying in verse 15, don't let that happen. See to it that that doesn't happen. So he's actually calling on the church to hold each other accountable, in a sense that if you see with your eyes a brother do something or a sister do something and it's not in harmony with their profession of faith in Christ, you're to make sure that doesn't happen again with them, that you go to them and confront that issue and see to it that it doesn't happen again. That's his term. So even if the theological thing has not been visibly seen with their eyes, as long as it's a clear, established truth from the Scriptures, the church has a responsibility to itself to see to it that certain things don't happen. And that brings us to the command that are in verse 15, what he specifically want to never happen. What does he specifically want the church to never do as individual believers making up the body? Two things. He wants them, according to the end of the verse, to never forsake the seeking or the pursuit of the good. And on the other hand, the opposite of that is, you see to it that nobody, even when they're subjected to evil by somebody else, that they respond with evil. See to it. Well, I don't know how good a job we're doing at that. See to it. I don't know what he expects us to do, except verse 14. Admonish, confront, expose the myth, whatever. But nonetheless, see to it. He may be addressing more the elders, but he hasn't quit talking to the brethren of verse 14 when he starts out in verse 15. So I'm assuming this is a general biblical responsibility that we all have, we all share. And there is something in here about the brethren, because in Paul's instruction, verse 14, he urges brethren, and now in verse 15, this is one of the things he's urging. And I want you to notice how critical the issue is, because he's actually talking about conclusions that the community, the church itself, is supposed to enforce. What are they? Well, in the first place, I want to start with the reverse thing, the last thing in verse 15. See to it that the church individuals, the members of the body of Christ, always seek after that which is good for one another and for all men. See to it. Now, he's obviously insistent here, because he says, see to it that they always seek after. See to it that they always seek after for one another. See to it that they always seek after for everybody. that would be pretty inclusive of even the evildoer. And that's the case. It's inclusive of the evildoer. So, he's talking about an inalterable aspect of the thing that is supposed to be seen to. You're always to be this way. You're always to be this way toward one another as fellow members of the body. You're always to be this way toward everybody. Always, always, always. What? Well, staying with the second half of the verse for right now, what are we always supposed to be doing? As individuals, what are we always supposed to be doing for one another and for everybody else? Well, he says, seek after that which is good. Now, that's a translation that means, he uses the word seek after that is typically used to mean persecute. This is dioko, it means to aggressively persecute somebody for doing something that you don't want them to do. Only the thing here is, you're supposed to be persecuting the good. What does that mean? Well, it means obviously that you're supposed to be on it like a tick on a dog. You're supposed to be on the good. And it's literally that, the good. Not always, not translated that which is good, but the good. You're supposed to be committed to this issue of pursuit and seeking after. The idea is, go after this. Make it your goal in life to persecute it, to prosecute it, if you want to say it that way. It actually has the idea of hounding somebody because they're not doing what you want them to do. Paul said in Galatians chapter 1 that he was going to be the top dog in his generation in terms of Pharisees. He was going to be the greatest Pharisee of the first century because he had a greater zeal than any of the other Pharisees. And what was his zeal? To persecute the church of Jesus Christ. He was so committed to that that he was actively persecuting them. And that's the word that's used here. And so that means that you have to be committed to something. Everybody is. And what he's saying is, you have to be committed to the good. Not everybody's committed to that. Doing what's the good. Now, that raises the question of, well, what is the good? What is it that we're supposed to be so committed to doing? He obviously implies by the command that there will be people that are Christians in the church who don't have this as their goal in life. And he is saying, see to it that that doesn't stay the case. See to it that that doesn't stay the case. In other words, see to it that everybody comes to the bottom line, and that is that they do the good. That is going to boil down to walking with the Lord day in and day out, following His leadership, trying to be sensitive to His Spirit, becoming more and more aware of what His Word says so that you can, that your body can be used by His Spirit to produce the testimony of Christ in every place you go. That's the ideal. And He is saying in a very real sense, see to it that that's the bottom line for everybody in the church. Well, what is the bottom line? The good. It's the word good with the definite article in front of it. We talked earlier or last time about the fact that He uses adjectives with a definite article in front to turn them into a kind of a noun or a nominal idea. And the established meaning in the context. I believe the established meaning of the context of the phrase the good is found in both verse 14 and 24. And that is, and also verse 11. This edification thing where being sanctified, being drawn more and more and more and more and more into the light and the truth and the joy of life, these are the things that are critical, and it should be a progressively developing reality where you get more and more enlightened, you become more and more like the light because you're walking in the light, you become more and more infused with the joy of the life because that's the response, that's the reaction. And being fundamentally committed to being sanctified is the bottom line. that's what's so tragic, I think, about people who say, well, you know, I believe in Jesus, so I'm going to go to heaven unless I die, and that's the big ticket, and that's all I really care about. Well, it is a fantastic thing to have heaven as your destination. That's what this whole letter is about. The Son coming from heaven so He can catch you up to be with Himself, and you'll be with Him forever. But I have a little problem with people who want to be with Him forever but don't want to be with Him now. I think that's contrary to the implications of the theology. That's what the word see means. Draw legitimate conclusions. What's the legitimate conclusion to the issue of a person's justification? Well, it's his sanctification. Because why in the world would you want to get right with God so you could spend eternity with Him if in fact you don't want to be right with God and you don't really have a strong interest in being with Him anyway? What's the point? Well, I just don't want to be in hell. Well, I understand that. And the more I think about hell and eternity, the better I understand it. But heaven is going to be hell for people who don't want to know God and don't want to spend any time with Him. And they're not really going to be there. I mean, we've talked about this before. Joy is at the right hand of the Father. If you want the joy, you've got to get where He is. If you say you want the joy, but you think you find it over there and over there and over there and over there, forget it. That's not where it is. It's over here. And that's the whole ministry of parakalesis. It's calling people alongside of the God of the joy of life. If a person says, well, all I'm worried about is whether I'm going to be in heaven and not hell at the end. Well, that's not true to start with. That's not all he's worried about. Because if that's all he was worried about, he would have no other concerns. And people who think like that have multitudes of concerns. Their lives are a disaster because of all of the concerns they have. So that's really not all they want. I think that every person who's ever had any introduction at all to joy wants more of it. And that's logical and rational, and Paul is actually saying, see to it that it happens. Well, how is it going to happen? Well, you're going to have to be committed to pursuing the good. Pursue the good. See to it. Well, there are several factors in the issue of seeing to it that you pursue the good, because number one, that means you're pursuing your own sanctification. Pursuing the good for one another means you're seeking your fellow believers' sanctification. And see to it that you pursue the good for all men means that you're going to be interested in seeing lost men come to know Christ. Because that's the only way that they can ever experience the good. Because the bottom line of the good, even if it's contextually identified as being sanctified, the bottom line of good is being a recipient of a benefit that's eternal and a real benefit and not a negative. So the good is a good result. It's a beneficial thing that lasts. And you're supposed to seek that good for everybody at all times. So that's the second thing that the verse says. Make sure this happens. And I think that he said it the other way. He says, see to it that no one repays evil for evil, but always seek after that which is good for everybody. He says it that way, but the way it works is you got to make up your mind to seek the good. And then when you get somebody doing some dastardly something to you, you'll be committed to seeking the good. And that means that you won't render evil against evil. If you haven't already made up your mind that you're going to seek the good, when somebody does evil to you, you'll respond with evil. It'll be a knee-jerk reaction, just like I told you about. Somebody does evil, and when you, even though you know it's not the thing to do, you respond likewise. Well, let's consider that. When he says, in the first part of the verse, see that no one repays another with evil for evil, we've already talked about the fact that we're not supposed to use evil as an instrument It's not supposed to be on our toolbox. We're supposed to be seeking the sanctification of everybody at all times, and therefore we can only use tools in the toolbox that will accomplish that. And in another place, Paul actually said, respond with good when evil is done, because good will triumph over it. That's a part of the toolbox. And that's the sum of the tools in the toolbox. So if you really want somebody to be sanctified, responding to their evil with evil will not accomplish that. It'll make them even more aggressively opposed. So in a very real sense, the good erases the evil. That's why Paul says be committed to pursuing the good. But this setting is specific. When evil has been done to someone, they typically immediately are in what I call reaction mode. Evil has been done, something hateful has been said, something hateful has been done, some injury has been inflicted, physically, emotionally, or spiritually, some evil has been done. It's not a good thing, it's a bad thing. And as soon as evil is done, people go into reaction mode. What's our reaction supposed to be? Well, this gets to be a really sticky wicket if we don't draw some firm lines around the settings of the verse. For example, if somebody does something evil to you, are you supposed to just let that go? Do the good? What is the good in a case like that? Well, that depends on how you define the evil. Because we're not required here. What we are required to do here is pursue the good, not use evil to do it. But what is evil in the case of somebody who's done evil to you? For example, if somebody commits a crime against you, is it a good thing for you not to press charges? No, it is not. And it is not evil to press charges. So pressing charges against somebody who does evil to you, if they violated a legal thing in your culture, that's not an evil thing. That's not responding to evil with evil. Somebody breaks into your house and threatens your family with physical violence and harm, is it an evil thing for you to take every action necessary to neutralize that threat? How are you supposed to be the protector of your family if you can't neutralize that kind of threat if you have the capability of doing it? So this is why I say it can get to be kind of a sticky wicket, because we tend to think in terms of everything that makes somebody physically or emotionally or spiritually pained is an evil. But that doesn't fly. Not in our culture and not in reason. For example, you get this tumor growing inside you that's growing and growing and growing and growing. And the doctor says, you know, that's all localized right there. It's just getting bigger and bigger. It's kind of, if you'll let us, we'll cut that out of you and you'll be done with it. Well, but doctor, if you take a knife and cut me open, that's going to hurt. We'll use some anesthesia. You won't feel it. Well, when I wake up, am I going to feel it? Well, yeah, but we'll give you some morphine, or we'll give you some oxycodone, or, you know, we'll keep you doped up enough to where it doesn't really hurt that bad. The fact is, the doctor cannot promise you that he isn't going to hurt you. But you don't see that as an evil. Nobody does. That is a good, because the infliction of the pain to get rid of the tumor is for your good. Same thing's true in a lot of the instructions the scriptures have given to the church in terms of dealing with people who are out of line, because sometimes you hurt them a great deal. But it's necessary. It's necessary. You can't let it go. So when it says don't respond to evil with evil, he's talking about responding to both an evil action with an evil intent, and he says don't respond with an evil action and an evil intent. Pursue the good. But recognize that sometimes the lines between the good and the appearance of evil get blurred, and we have to be very careful that we see to it that we are reasonable in our understanding. as we think our way through this process. That's what see to it means. Think along these lines until you draw the right conclusions. In a good part of the scriptures, Jesus is recorded in some of the Gospels, for example, as saying that you shouldn't resist evil, you should turn the other cheek, if somebody requires you to walk a mile and carry their stuff, then you should walk 2 miles. If they want your coat, you're supposed to give them your cloak too. And a lot of people think, well, what are we supposed to do with that? Well, look at the context first. Because almost every illustration that Jesus uses within that context is authority established evil. Not just anybody in the first century could require you to carry their stuff for a mile. Only a Roman soldier could do that. And if he did, you were to carry it 2 miles. That's overcoming evil with good. The whole idea of giving your coat and your cloak too, that's in a court of law. Those illustrations are all under the entrenched evil of fallen governmental systems. And in fallen governmental systems, when the system imposes evil on you, you're supposed to take it. Jesus, as a lamb to the slaughter, went silent. He didn't answer. He didn't resist it. He just, okay, this is Rome doing this, or this is Sanhedrin doing this. I have a responsibility to yield to it. I'm not going to respond with evil. Going to let it go. But those are the kinds of things that we have to wrestle with if we're going to see to it. There are two things in the verse that we're to see to. First, in reverse, we're to see to it that each one of us is committed to the good, progressive sanctification. And the second thing is, in that setting, we're to see to it that when one person has been subjected to evil, that we make sure that person does not respond to that evil with evil. It's kind of like guy shoots his neighbor's dog. The neighbor is enraged by the injustice done, so he sets a fire to the neighbor's house. That's responding evil to evil. Both of them were evil actions. Both of them illegal actions. Both of them hurtful actions, and they're not supposed to be done. So those are the kinds of things that we're on the lookout for, and this is what Paul is telling the church in Thessalonica to do. And if they do it, their testimony for Christ will grow, because it will be consistent, it will be good, it will be producing sanctification, and people won't be doing evil. Certainly they won't be reacting to evil, but they certainly also ought not to be initiating it, as they're supposed to be pursuing the good.